And so I have to do this little statement. So I
That's
say,
okay. All right.
The purpose or the key objective of this interview is to serve as a research tool to document memories of the American chestnut in the southern Appalachian region. Information obtained in these interviews will be retained and made available for further use in efforts to promote a better understanding of the role of the American chestnut in Appalachian culture. So I'm say, have you signed the participant identification and release agreement?
I have.
All right. So first, can you just state who you are?
Okay.
When you were born, where you grew up, that kind of background information.
My name is Rex Mann. I grew up in Western North Carolina, near Asheville, but in very rural setting. I recently retired from the U.S. Forest Service, a little better than 41 years with the Forest Service, and almost all that was spent in the South, and a good deal of it within the range of the American chestnut in the Southern Appalachians. I worked in Virginia and a couple of places in North Georgia, and of course I've been in Kentucky for 20-some years. I graduated from North Carolina State in 1967 with a BS degree in forest management. I remember my senior year, a U.S. Forest Service representative, a little seminar on chestnut. I remember this Forest Service rep, I don't remember his name, telling the group that the American chestnut was gone forever. The Department of Agriculture and the Forest Service had stopped their decades-long effort to breed up a blight-resistant chestnut, and it was more kind of, hey, it's gone, we got to accept it and move on. It's not coming back.
What year were you born?
Oh, I was born in 1944, July of 1944. So I am 63. I don't know if this is, I can tell you, my father, I'm of the generation whose fathers and mothers remembered the chestnut and what it meant to the Appalachian culture. And I remember this story my dad told when he was a young man. Most of his life he was a lay minister in the Baptist church, but when he was a young man, he was fairly rough and made a good deal of whiskey. And during the Depression, he and a cousin, there was no work. It was really hard times in Waynesville, Canton area of Western North Carolina. So they had, they would load up this Model A Ford with chestnuts and moonshine whiskey. And they would travel to Washington, D.C., and they would, they were street vendors, you know. They would have a little place there on the streets where they would just sell chestnuts. But I guess where the real money came from, enough money to pay for the gasoline, was from occasionally selling a little moonshine whiskey to wash the chestnuts down. But that was, he got a total of 6 years education. Actually, where he got his education was in the old abandoned forestry school in the Pink Beds, they call it. It's the part of the Vanderbilt estate. It's where the first forestry school in the U.S. was located. And this school went on for about 3 or 4 years, I think. It was abandoned. My father's father worked for a logging company that was logging that before the Forest Service took it over, and so his education was in that little school building that's now been restored as part of the Cradle of Forestry there. But my dad was a big hunter. He was a logger. He dropped out of school when he was 12 years old to work, to take a job with the car lumber company where his dad was working. And one of the few times I ever saw him show any emotion was when he would talk about the chestnut and what the passing of the chestnut meant from just a cultural standpoint, from a wildlife standpoint, because I don't know if he realized this or not, but he was a big hunter, ardent hunter, and wildlife populations plummeted about that time, maybe mostly over hunting, but with the passing of the chestnut, that really added to the woes, and things like the wild turkey just disappeared from western North Carolina. But my head was filled with stories about the chestnut, and I had an interest in that. My first job was in Virginia, and the woods were full at that time of what we called old gray ghosts, just the old standing snags of American chestnut. And I saw that there. I saw it in Georgia, where I spent about 6 years working. And from the earliest days of my Forest Service career, I was really interested in the chestnut. I was an ardent collector of chestnut lumber.
Where would you find most of it? Was it?
Well, it was in when I worked in Virginia, the Forest Service had purchased this old farm to add to the National Forest, and they had no use for the barns, so they were going to auction them off. And the same day I found out I was being transferred to Georgia, I found out that I had successfully bid on the rights to tear down these old buildings, and it was 9 outbuildings including 2 big barns. But I had a month to tear them down, clean up the site, go to Georgia, find a place to live, and move my family to Georgia. So I put some long, long days in salvaging this really beautiful lumber. And I had to be fairly ruthless because of the time constraints, and if a board was broken or busted, I burned it, you know. But I did salvage 2,000 or 3,000 feet of.
Is that what's?
Actually, not. This is. This also came from an old barn. The flooring in the house here came from an old barn here in eastern Kentucky, and that's where you find it. That's where you find the lumber now. In fact, if you notice, you probably know this, but it's full of wormholes. And but this borer that created the wormholes only came into the tree after it was dead. Mm-hmm. So all this lumber was salvaged from the forest, probably 1939 or 40 or 41 in that era, and a lot of it went into barns. So that's where you find it right now, is tearing down old barns.
Did you find that, like, other people in the Forest Service with you or other people in your forestry program knew much about chestnuts, or do they have kind of similar attitudes or experiences as you, or different?
I think most people, even today, there is a tremendous interest, at least in the Southern Appalachians, among forestry professionals in the chestnut. It's they've heard all the stories, they've read about it, they've never seen the tree actually growing, other than just the sprouts that came up in the forest. But you generally see a passion for chestnut among foresters. It's like the Holy Grail. I can't remember when I joined the American Chestnut Foundation. It was sometime in the 90s. And I was just fascinated that hey, maybe after all, there is a chance that this tree can be brought back. But I really wasn't active in the organization until 2000, when I met Bob Cornett, and I was asked by Marshall Case, the president of the American Chestnut Foundation, if we could start a chapter in Kentucky. So I took that on, and we did.
What kind of response did you find?
Well, we had, you know, it's not one of the largest chapters in the system. We've always hovered, we've had 200 members or maybe a few more, and oddly enough, that membership is scattered all across the state.
It's
not.
What kind of people do you get?
Well,
what range? Yeah.
A high percentage of them are people like myself who heard the chestnut stories, but they're also, oddly enough, a lot of doctors, medical doctors who seem to have a strong interest in this when they hear about it. Folks in academia, but a lot of folks who just like myself grew up hearing chestnut stories. Mm-hmm. So, but we also have some young people who are just absolutely fascinated by the opportunity to be a part of bringing it back. Mm-hmm. You know, it has had an intern we were able to hire in Kentucky, a young man named Mike French at University of Kentucky. And he'd kind of drifted. He'd been in school. He's smart, very smart kid, but he'd been in school for 6 or 7 years, and we were able to pick him up as an intern to help with the pollination, the breeding, the planting of orchards. And I'm telling you, that redirected that young man's life. He is he's just winding up his master's degree, but he is very, very passionate about this. Yeah. I'll give you contact information.
Yeah,
on Mike. He's really
where's he from?
He's actually from E-Town. But right now he's working for a tree planting contractor. He got involved, Mike did, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but
yeah,
but he got involved with a group at University of Kentucky who figured out how to get trees growing on strip mines.
Yeah, I've heard the story.
Okay.
About that, yeah.
And Mike did his master's on this,
mm-hmm,
so he is a leading authority on this, and I can tell you that TACF also has become very active partner in that effort.
Yeah, I saw that Associated Press article a month or so ago.
Yeah, it really is. When you think in terms of expanding the forested acres in this country,
yeah,
strip mines offer
Tennessee, there's
absolutely
enough of them, man.
Kentucky, we've got,
yeah,
got it's in the millions of acres.
Yeah.
You know that we. And if you go to Letcher County or there east, you see, particularly if you fly over that country.
I've never done that, but I kind of want to.
Ooh, it's.
That's what I've heard.
It's the narrow pathway that TACF has to walk in this is,
mm-hmm,
we're not endorsing strip mining.
Right.
But if you're going to have stripped out areas, hey, let's get,
yeah,
them back into forest.
The reality is they're there.
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah, and we're likely to have more.
Yeah.
And, but that is a huge success story to be able to bring And Chestnut has fit very well into that because not only are we restoring stripped out land, but we're restoring a species. And so it has, it's kind of a natural fit and a tremendous amount of interest in that right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit curious, you're talking about that your father, grandfather were loggers.
Mm-hmm.
And so would they have been logging Chestnut a lot?
Was absolutely. That popular? Oh, absolutely. I've heard
more
my
so
dad.
Than other, or why would that be more?
Well, for one thing, in Western North Carolina, it truly was a high percentage of the forest was American chestnut. It probably actually reached the peak of its growth in Tennessee, Western North Carolina. Huge trees. I mean, I've heard my dad talk about they would leave branches in the woods. They only got the best. That was the sad part about that early logging, is that they only took the best. And but at that, they had logs that were absolutely huge, and it was not the most valuable tree in the woods from a financial return, but it was a very utilitarian species. It was used for everything. The biggest attraction, of course, was the rot resistance of the tree. And something that's fascinated me here in East Kentucky in the bluegrass region, where you had wealthy people. It's not true in this old house. It may have been true in the original house that was here. But if you a high percentage of these old brick homes had chestnut flooring in them, and clear chestnut, no wormholes. It was, I think because of its rot resistance.
Would that have been brought into the bluegrass?
It had to be brought in. The closest, the mountains you see in the distance there is Powell County, and chestnut grew there. And that's where it would likely have been brought in from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember some book, maybe it was Harry Cottle's Night Comes to the Cumberland, but how they would just float them down the river towards
they would. Yeah, at one time, the little community of Clay City, which is only about 15 miles from here, on the Red River, and at one time the largest hardwood sawmill in the United States was there, you know, now they had railroad, but they used the river before the railroad was put in.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to talk to somebody from there.
I can give you a name.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. But it, or I get off on a tangent again, but if you look at the early history of that Red River Gorge country, the story goes that a lot of the gunpowder that Andrew Jackson used in the Battle of New Orleans came from East Kentucky, and it was floated down the river in riverboats. There was no easy access, no markets for the people who lived here back on the eastern seaboard. The terrain, there was no roads, their markets were down the Mississippi, and from an early, oh gosh, 18 teens, 20s, they began taking produce and gunpowder, floating it down the river to New Orleans, and then they would tear the boats up and sell the lumber because it was not practical to try to bring them back to Kentucky, and they would walk back up the Natchez Trace, which comes very close to Chattanooga, and mm-hmm. but they would walk back to eastern Kentucky, and About one trip a year is all they could make, but they, but it was that was the market. I don't know where I was going with that rambling dissertation, but the amazing thing is that the chestnut was used even in the bluegrass here, and time period that lumber had to be hauled in by wagon because that preceded railroads or floated down the Kentucky River perhaps and. To a mill, but it was widely used, and in the same there is the same cultural connection with people as it relates to chestnut of eastern Kentucky as there was in East Tennessee or western North Carolina. It was all the people were very similar, and their culture was very similar, and they all depended on the chestnut.
So can you speak some about why or how it was a more of a, you know, obviously it was in the Appalachian range, but how the chestnut was important to rural people versus more urban people?
Well, you have to look at, it's always struck me that the people who lived in the mountains were almost more hunter-gatherers than they were farmers. They depended on the chestnut as part of their food supply. All their livestock, particularly hogs, they just turned them in the mountains, and they depended on that dependable chestnut crop to fatten up their stock. Another part of the early history of this country that it was true of East Kentucky that fascinated me was after that stock was fattened up, they actually drove it all the way through Kentucky, through the Tennessee Valley, and then followed the French Broad River up to Asheville, and they call that the Buncombe Turnpike. But it was a major travel way for livestock that went to the plantations of South Carolina primarily and parts of Georgia. This enabled the big slaveholders to devote all their land to growing cash crops, but they depended on the people of Appalachia for meat, and they drove turkeys, hogs. It was a part of the history of this country, the way people made a living that few know about right now, because it all ended when the Civil War ended. You know, that market dried up, and they no longer really drove livestock from Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, down to South Carolina and Georgia. But at one time, that was a very profitable enterprise. And I've read old accounts of Asheville, which was the main waypoint as they were going south, of literally hundreds of thousands of head of cattle, hogs, turkey, that moved through Asheville on their way mm-hmm. south. And most of that stuff was, that livestock was just free roaming livestock, and particularly the pigs, they depended on chestnut to fatten them up, you know, to get them in good condition so that they can move south. I'm babbling. Go ahead.
No, I always wonder how a hog a hog fattened on chestnuts would taste different than a hog fat. Have you ever heard anything about that?
I have heard that. Yes, I've heard my dad speak that.
I've heard it's different, but I wonder how.
Well, I can tell you from the rural background I had, you know, when the chestnut disappeared, then they fattened them on corn. But the chestnut, I had always heard, just really gave a good flavor to the meat, but it was also very nutritious, very very efficient. What am I trying to say? It was a very efficient food, you mm-hmm. know, that didn't take a lot of chestnuts to put on weight for the pigs, and the thing about it was you could depend on that. It was a very dependable source of food. Few of us have any idea how much the wildlife sustaining capability of these mountains decreased with the passing of the chestnut.
Mm-hmm.
And in the long run, I absolutely believe that that will be much more important in the restoration effort than the timber values of it.
Mm-hmm.
That this ability to once again have a very dependable annual massed crop. The oaks are not dependable. They're very sporadic. But the chestnut was, because it bloomed so late, it was dependable. And they produced, each tree produced huge amounts of chestnuts.
Were the chestnut, or do you know anything about like how people in the southern Appalachian region were more or less dependent on chestnuts than people in the northeastern range of it? And also, were the trees any different in size or mass production down here?
I think two things. One, in the southern Appalachians, I think they were more, generally more plentiful. Now, that's, Pennsylvania had many chestnut trees, but they did get larger, and mass producing capability is a function of size. So I think there probably were more chestnut trees and generally more chestnut mast. The other thing that I believe is that most of those mountaineers simply didn't have enough good flat land to fully sustain their family. So they depended on what grew in the woods a whole lot more than, for example, people who in Ohio or southern Indiana that had acres and acres of really good plowable land. I don't know if I answered the question.
No, that was good. That's kind of what I was looking for. And then another question I wanted to ask before I move on is, people I've talked to so far have talked about how, you know, the barns would be made out of chestnut and split rail fences, but I'm curious if there's any other, like, tools or any other kind of obscure things that have been, that you've come across in your collecting or anything like that.
Obscure
chestnut things.
I'm restoring this old log cabin. Many of the log cabins were, this one is not, because it was right at the edge of the mountains, and they used whatever wood was handy, what was available. But that was a major, a high percentage of the log cabins were built from chestnut, the shingles, and I'm going through shingle making 101 down here trying to learn how to do that, and I'm using red oak, northern red oak, which splits very easily. But the a preferred species when it was here was American chestnut, again because it was very easy to work. It split just as easy as the oak, and it wouldn't decay. It would last much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal to these folks to not have to replace that roof every 10 or 15 years. But you hit on another one is the fencing. And generally, people fenced to keep livestock out of certain places then, instead of trying to keep livestock in. It was open range. But there were literally thousands of miles of fencing. And this took huge amounts of American chestnut. And that was what was favored,
mm-hmm.
Again, because of its rot resistance. That was a huge part of how the tree was used.
Mm-hmm.
Was for fencing.
I think it's interesting too, something I've kind of thought about but not really studied as much on. Like, I kind of know the history of Eastern Kentucky with like this like subsistence small farming, and then when the railroads came in, it changed to these like camp, like small little camp row houses, whatever, and you had the kind of more towns, and people switched from this, like, living off the land, living off their immediate kind of, you know, haul or whatever, to this kind of different lifestyle. And it seems like it's really interesting to me that the like, shift in lifestyle, like, rural Appalachian lifestyle was happening concurrent with this chestnut blight. I'm curious, like, how much of that had to do, I don't know if you could point to how, you know, that
whether
it seems like a lot of things happening at once, sort of.
They did. I don't know that we could say that the demise of the chestnut drove people to a different lifestyle. I think it was, the development of mining and the coming of the railroads, perhaps more than anything else. And again, high percentage of railroad ties were American chestnut. You know, a high percentage of the early telegraph poles were American chestnut for the same reasons that it lasted so long. But I think what you're talking to is very true. The people who live in Eastern Kentucky right now, as far as their ability to sustain themselves off the land, there it's a far cry from where their grandparents were or their great-grandparents. One of the things that I've noticed in my career, we are an urban society, and even people who live in the mountains, more and more their values are becoming urban values. They know no more about the history, or what grows in the woods than somebody from Louisville or wherever. You know, it's and I think television probably has a lot to do with that. And a lot of these people, they if they work, they work in a city. You know, they go, it's just the sad part of
it is like, so
where we are.
I just feel like living in Whitesburg for a couple of years was interesting to me, because to see, like, people are connected to their home place. Like, people want to live in, you know, live up the street from their sister, their parents, whatever. But, yeah, they drive, like, to go work at the Walmart or work at the fast food restaurant.
Absolutely.
That's all there is.
And what it seems like what brings them back, or why the ties is just, it's family. It's not necessarily experiences they had in the woods of Eastern Kentucky that I don't think. It's because their values are becoming urban values.
Mm-hmm.
They really are.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me too. Like, why have people rejected some of that? Like, doing
my
for
own.
Kinda,
well, my own. I'll be careful here, but the it seems like the one group of people, the one minority in this country that it's okay for most people to make fun of are people from Appalachia.
I agree.
And so they I think they feel, I think they're not proud of their heritage, you know, like their grandfathers were. They're not proud of that self-sufficiency that was once the earmark of the people who lived here. I think that has a powerful effect on them, and that's a very real thing. I can tell you that looking on the people of Appalachia is, you know, not quite up to the standard of where society is today. It's very widespread.
Mm-hmm.
It is very widespread.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's like there's two sides to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to embrace it, but you don't want to be.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, I think that's right.
And,
yeah. Yeah. You don't want people to think you're a hillbilly.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're casting aside the things that really distinguish these people here in these mountains, mm-hmm. that self-sufficiency.
Or it's like, I can call myself a hillbilly, but I don't want someone,
yeah.
you know,
that's exactly
outside
right.
calling me
yeah,
a hillbilly.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that's yeah. really interesting stuff to me, too. Okay, one other thing I've been asking folks about is, like, are there any traditions or sayings, songs, kind of like celebrations that you've heard about, like my grandmother has all these old kind of sayings about, you know, dull as a fro, or these like kind of sayings. I'm curious if there's any of those that are relate to Chestnut. Are there also like, are there any gatherings or celebrations that you've heard people tell you about over the years?
Well, a tale from my father that in the fall of the year when the chestnuts fell, a common thing for he and his buddies as they were running over the mountains, was they'd go in the woods and they would rake up the leaves and the chestnut burrs in one huge pile, and they'd set them on fire, and they would roast the chestnuts out of those. Wouldn't even think about doing that today, you know, with... But that was a normal thing they did, to have a little snack in the woods. And you hear old timers here in East Kentucky talk about stomping the chestnut burrs barefoot, you know, with their heel to open the things up. And you wouldn't find many people today doing that. Maybe one time, but you. I don't know that I've heard the dull as a fro.
Those kind of like sayings.
And see, the something that fascinates me is that all those sayings were, I'm trying to think all the sayings that we inherited from our fathers, grandfathers, that were passed down through the generation. If you look at them, a lot of them are tied to that culture, the animals, you know, that they worked with, that were a part of their life. And that wouldn't be true of this generation today. You know, trying to think a good example, but you wouldn't say dull as a fro.
Yeah,
you would say
she's mad as a cat with a paper tail.
Yeah, or like, mad as an old wet hen, you know, and they're just literally thousands.
I know, I love this. I lived with her for a couple months, and she would just say them. I'd be like, what did you just say?
Yeah, but see, I can imagine an old wet hen, you know, an old setting hen, how angry they would be, because you don't mess with one, you know, they'll...
Yeah.
But those are, when my mom was alive, somewhere I've got written down, when I was talking to her, I'd get a book and I would just write down some of the things that she would say. They were almost, they were from a different era. It's almost,
Yeah, I feel like there must have been some about Chestnut.
There probably were, but I have to tell you, I don't know that I that I've ever heard of any that directly related to the Chestnut. Mm-hmm. Although I think you're right. There almost had to be.
I'll keep asking people if I come across some.
If I think of any, I'll email them to you.
Yeah, So I guess you said that you remembered your dad being really getting nostalgic or sentimental when talking about the chestnut blight. But I'm curious if there's do you remember the first time you heard about blight, or do you remember the blight firsthand? Or I guess
I don't because in North Carolina. It was mostly gone by the end of the Second World War, and I have no memories of that. But It was a topic of conversation. You know, I'd heard that story of the blight, literally thousands of times, and of course was too young to really understand it, except it was a bad thing. It was a bad thing. And I know my dad always thought, hey, somehow that thing will come back, you know, somehow it will come back on its own. Of course, I think the odds of that are minuscule, really. But trips to the woods, somewhere I've got a... one time he took me to an old home place that he lived in for a while. And there was an old fence post there that had survived. It was made out of chestnut. And I remember carrying that thing with me and moving it all over the country, and I still got it somewhere. You know, the way those people lived, the way my family lived, and the way a lot of people in Eastern Kentucky lived is, man, it was rough. I can remember my dad talking about when they moved, and they moved a lot following the logging jobs. And when he was a child, his job, when they moved, and they moved everything they owned in an old sled, not a wagon, but a sled that was, and his job was to hold the lamp chimney, you know, glass, the glass on it, which was really valuable, you know, you didn't, but it would be wrapped up, and his job was to hold that while they were moving, to keep it from being broken. I've heard him talk about, he lived in a number of cabins like this thing right here, and for some strange reason, it would keep the rain out, generally. But in the wintertime, when you had snow and a driving, wind-driven snow, say you'd wake up in the morning and they'd just be covered with snow up there in the loft of that old cabin. But I've heard other people in Kentucky talk about that.
I guess you have an interesting perspective, because you had sort of like the science community, forestry community, and then also... do you think there's any sort of difference in attitudes about the blight and about whether or not it could be restored and all that between like the forestry people and then just kind of the mountain people?
Yeah, there is. Generally, an awful lot of people have just a passing knowledge, very superficial knowledge of this effort to bring the chestnut back. But they're fascinated by it. They're drawn to it. Just a couple of weeks ago, I went down to Clay City. They have a little old mill day, and there's just people there with everything from cross-cut saws to making wooden bowls. And I talked to a couple of young people there, fairly young people that own land, and I'd tell them about the science of this chestnut thing, and they're just absolutely intrigued by it. When you start to, you have to explain the science in terms that they can understand, and they may not fully grasp it, all the intricacies of the science, but they grasp that it's good science and it'll work. And my own personal belief is that when we get to the point of restoring this thing, and I've really done a lot of thinking about that, I think basically what we will do is ask willing landowners to let us use their land for a decade or two. I think there will be literally thousands of people like that that will say, yes, you can, I'll take care of it. Or we'll get a group. Bob Cornett wants local communities to do this, but it could be a school group, Boy Scouts, a wildlife club. But I think we'll have no trouble getting people to adopt these spots. And what we will do is, I'm getting off on another tangent, but we will nurture these chestnuts, take care of them, until they get to the point where wildlife can't hurt them. That's the biggest challenge we have. We may have to fence these areas, but where they start producing nuts, and then it'll restore itself, basically. I think that's the mechanism or the process that will take place. But it will literally change TACF, the American Chestnut Foundation. When we get into that phase, it's going to be all about working with willing landowners and volunteers. Mm-hmm. And they're out there. I also believe that they're hundreds of moneyed people who will give money if they can see where that tree is growing and they're part of that restoration. If they would, I don't think we'll have a great deal of difficulty in finding people to help us with that. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be just managing that effort, because you still have to have the science to make sure it's done right. Mm-hmm. But I don't think many people realize what a huge, huge effort that's going to be. And most of the American public, even the people that don't even know what you're talking about with chestnut, but if you talk to them in terms of restoring a species, bringing something back that we all thought we'd lost, that really resonates with them. And because everybody, green is the word right now. Any kind of restoration, it really goes to the heart, you know, and people will really respond to that, I believe. Particularly in an era of climate change and the threat of losing all these other species. And here we're doing something that's never in the history of mankind been accomplished, and that is bring back a species that we thought was lost.
Yeah.
And that will really attract a lot of people. I'm absolutely convinced of it.
Yeah. One more thing about the blight. Some people talked about different. So when people down here, you know, knew that there's this blight coming down, mm-hmm. I know like one, I guess the Forest Service, backed this program of cutting all the trees down or something. That was their response. But were there any other kind of like interesting responses or ways people responded to the blight or actions that they took?
You know, you're right in one thing. First of all, even with an exotic species like the chestnut blight, and this is true of insects or diseases, it's highly unusual for a blight or an insect to totally destroy its food source. Just doesn't happen. We had pine beetle epidemic here some years ago that, on this forest, we had the northernmost population of red-cockaded woodpeckers. And this is a species that's absolutely dependent on living pine trees, and you have to burn and really maintain specific conditions. And it took out most of the pine trees in Tennessee and Kentucky. But it didn't get them all. And the speculation is that when the Forest Service and the Department of Agriculture said, the game's over with, you guys better salvage this timber before the blight gets it, because it won't be worth as much, we may very well have cut down some trees that had some natural blight resistance. Mm-hmm. Very possible. We'll
likely never know. Most of the efforts, if you look at the history of, in Pennsylvania, there was a huge effort to clear a swath that went span the state and stop the southern spread of this thing. But it didn't work. Before they, even after they were well into it, it didn't work, you know. And shortly after that, they realized it was hopeless. But the science just simply, the science wasn't there. Forest Service and the Department of Agriculture spent 40 or 50 years breeding, just crossing American chestnut with Chinese. And they never went any further with the crossing program. It was all that, just that first cross. And some of them were, had a lot of blight resistance, but they simply couldn't keep up with the other vegetation. They were overtopped, and it was deemed a failure. But I think all the efforts, the primary effort was the business of trying to actually cut the trees. And you see this same thing at work right now with emerald ash borer. There's talk in somewhere in Ohio and Michigan to cut a huge swath, several counties cut every ash tree down to try to keep that thing from spreading further southward. It's almost hopeless. It doesn't work that way. If we were not able to come up with some science-based rather than some physical act, we'll lose the ash trees. There's no question about that. And when I talk about, I have a fairly pessimistic view of where we are with our forests. I can rattle off, you know, we're almost every species that grows out there has some invasive species coming after it. The ash borer, take out the ash. We got an exotic that's killing the beech trees, butternut or white walnut is passing, dogwood has a, then there is this sudden oak death that's currently in California and one county in Oregon that kills almost everything that grows in the woods. And if that thing ever makes it to the East Coast, and it can be spread by bicycle tires, even boots when you pick up the spores of this thing. We don't have any science that would protect these woods right here. So, and to me, that is the scenario that we're facing for your career. It is that we're going to see continued threats. You'll see the loss of other species. But here in the midst of that, you've got this one effort through good science, and I'm convinced it's good science, to actually bring back a species. And that's huge. That will be huge. And the lesson there is a good deal more of the resources of this country need to go into that effort, you know. I think I'm really getting off on a tangent here, but I really think that what we have done, we are doing with American chestnut, a well-thought-out, well-executed breeding program, first time this has ever been done with a tree, but a scientific effort to bring back a species by breeding blight resistance into that tree. I think that will be a template for how we bring back other species. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Now, the scary part about it, the other real possibility is gene manipulation. And the American public, in my view, is not ready for that right now.
What do you mean by that?
You take, and there are places working on this. There's another term for it. Genetic engineering.
Okay.
Where you may bring a gene in from a completely different species that will function. And again, this stuff is advancing. The knowledge there is really advancing. But it's like the cloning Dolly, the sheep. You know, that scares the bejesus out of people right there. You know, we're not ready to accept that. But I think down the road we might. You know, in agriculture, you hear about food riots, people starving to death right now because of ethanol production. You know, you'll hear more and more that every gallon of ethanol we make from corn means that some kid somewhere is going to starve to death. That's pretty harsh stuff right there. But the gains that have been made in agriculture, a lot of those are genetic engineering. That, man, they've got crops right now that they can put some substance in into the chromosomes that makes it resistant to different insects or disease, and so you get huge crop yields. And if you're going to feed the people of this country, that's probably inevitable that we're going to do that. But right now, there's still great resistance to it, and that is much different from what we're doing with the chestnut, where we're taking a first cousin of the American chestnut that had this. That had grown up with chestnut blight over hundreds of thousands of years, and we're simply taking that gene and putting it into the American chestnut, and that's much more acceptable to the American public. But the key point there, I think there will be tremendous pressure on TACF to get on with this, you know, to accelerate the restoration, and I think it would be criminal if we limited our work just purely to American chestnut. I think that we have to use our experiences, our knowledge, because if that science worked for American chestnut, it'll work for something else, you know, and I think we have to do that, and that's. Most people in TACF are not really ready for that move yet. Mm-hmm. That's kind of scary to them. But I think that we will have a much broader objective as the years go by.
One other thing I'm curious about too is so are y'all doing anything to? I guess it's hard to forecast, but is. So who's to say that if you plant this blight-resistant tree, something else won't come along?
And there are no assurances of that. For example, up until the time of the Civil War, shortly before the Civil War, we now know that chestnut grew out of the mountains. It grew all the way to Charlotte, North Carolina. It grew in the Piedmont areas rather than the mountains. And we now believe that there is this exotic root rot.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
You've probably heard of, and that was brought in probably through the plantation owners around the Atlantic coast that absolutely eliminated chestnut. And there's references to this. So the chestnut tree's dying. And it retreated to the mountains where this fungus or root rot had a much tougher time. So what we have to do now, and there are some efforts ongoing with this, is while we breed up a tree to resist this fungus, the chestnut blight, we also have to be thinking about a tree that's also resistant to this root rot. But there, again, the pessimistic view, we're not going to stop these exotics from coming into this country. We need to try. They're all coming in through world trade, mostly with Asia. We need to try to restrict it, but the reality is we don't even know what's already out there. So it'll be a continuing battle in our lifetimes and beyond to use this science to also, the breeding programs probably will never stop. It's nice to, everybody would prefer that somehow the chestnut beat this thing on its own. That ain't going to happen, you know, nor will it likely happen with a lot of the other exotics that are coming in. And my view is that this will be a huge focus area for this country in the years to come. Mm-hmm. We have to, or we'll lose everything we value out there. And it's not just cultural things that are important now. I think that by the time you reach middle age, a huge part of the fuel that we power our automobiles with will come from cellulose out of these woods we have. And, you know, we're very close to that right now. And it won't come from corn. There's very definite limits on how much of that we can do. But the woods will have value be much more important than just the cultural reasons that we talk about with chestnut right now. I believe that's an old man's ramblings here.
You've already talked about a good bit of this already, but as far as the restoration effort goes, you might have already said this, but when did you get involved and what motivated you to get involved?
Well, the reason I joined to start with was the baggage I brought with me of what this tree meant. In a word, it's probably my dad, okay? Just because before he died, we would talk about this, and man, he was really interested in it. He knew nothing about it, and it's hard to explain science to this old guy, but so the passion has always been there. But what's fascinated me for the last 7 or 8 years is the actual job. How, as a forester, I've been involved in this all my life, planting trees or manipulating the forest, but the actual job of how we're going to get this thing reestablished, which is the goal of the group, not only to breed a tree, but to actually put it back in the woods. That is mind-boggling. And raises all sorts of issues. I can tell you, for example, that the Park Service has not embraced this because in their minds, this is a hybrid. You know, it's got Chinese genes in it, okay? Even though it's 94% American. There are environmental groups who will not embrace this because it is technically a hybrid. And they some of these folks have a very purist view of the world. But the reality is that once you set this thing in motion, it will, most of the work, most of the spreading of this tree will be accomplished by squirrels, chipmunks, and blue jays. And in a word, Park Service and those who maybe don't want to see this happen, once you populate a bunch of these grids and they get to dominant position in the canopy. There's no turning that around. It's gonna happen. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that strikes me about this, and I spent a lifetime working for the Forest Service, the government, the federal government, but it is not the federal government that's doing this. This is a private, nonprofit group of very passionate people. But once this process is started, there's a lot of people have a stake in it, a dog in this fight, if you will. And it's not just a simple thing of saying, hey, we're ready, let's go put them in the woods. It could be potentially controversial, although I think that the bulk of the people of this country would say, hey, walks like a duck, sounds like a duck, it's a duck, it's American chestnut. Let's get on with it. That's good. 94% is plenty good enough. And there are scientists that argue, hey, you really don't have a different species here. When you have that percentage, it's American chestnut. There are those who would argue otherwise, but there will be a certain element of controversy that goes with this. I think it's unavoidable. But I think, again, given the environment that we're in, where we're actively seeing other species die, we're looking at climate change, we're looking at energy crisis in this country, that most of the people will say, hey, that's the sensible thing to do. That's the smart thing to do. Mm-hmm. But some groups have more or less drawn a line in the sand that's going to be difficult for them to back up from, you know. Mm-hmm. So there will be some controversy. And the Smokies, the Great Smokies, may not want this thing growing on their land, but as years go by, they'll see it growing on their land. And I'm not sure what they would do at that point. First of all, they'd have to determine, is this a real American chestnut, or is this one of these newfangled things that somebody planted several miles down the road? But I think about those issues that will go along with this effort to bring back. But in my mind, it's the right thing to do. It's the only course of action that makes any sense. Man is the great destroyer, but we're also the only ones who can restore it. And, so it's that's why I say the field of work that you're going into is very, very critical. Because it's going to be the human aspect of this thing rather than the science. That's going to be the real challenges, I think, in the years to come.
Has there been any other efforts, like private effort, restoration efforts, that you could, in the Southeast or even anywhere that you can think of this magnitude? Or?
Oh, not never for a tree. Never for a tree. Now, with chestnut, there's a group in Virginia, Blacksburg, Virginia, a small organization of a professor and his wife, and that they're it's not TACF, but they're very close. But their belief is that, hey, let's find the few trees that have survived.
Oh, yeah, the cooperators.
Yes, the cooperators group. Yeah. I think everybody says let's go on with that, but TACF and this active tree breeding program is the one that's approaching the starting gate right now, and those folks are they're not there. Mm-hmm. The other thing is we have one chapter in New York that is solely going with the genetic engineering. Aspect of this thing, and they say they're getting close to having a tree that they have genetically engineered that can compete very well. Mm. But
so you guys are kind of like the middle of the rip, like they're kind of the extreme.
Yeah, really, as an organization, we're struggling with how to deal with that, and I guess it's the best way to put it is we believe that what we're doing with this crossbreeding is the best way to go right now, offers the best chance of success.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't discount what's happening in that whole genetic engineering thing. And thing that keeps coming back to me is the American public is not ready for that yet, I don't think. It's scary to most people. Mm-hmm. But those other efforts are out there. But most of this type of work has occurred with food crops, wheat, corn, all the major food crops, but not with the tree species. And you probably know that the guy who provided the initial science for this, this Dr. Burnham back in the early 80s, he was a crop breeder. You know, mm-hmm.
Heard a little bit about
him. One of the things that I plan to do is to go to Minnesota, if this illness doesn't delay that, and meet with the first president of the American Chestnut Foundation, a guy who worked very closely with that Dr. Burnham, left the outfit and now runs a private tree breeding program up in Minnesota. But I've found out, I've had several conversations with him, and he has devoted about 15 or 20 years to really studying this problem of how do you physically put this tree back in the woods. So I'm going to go up and spend a couple of days with him. I'm going to, my buddy Hill is going to give me some thoughts. I've heard from several other people on the committee. But my intent is by our annual meeting in October to have a plan that I could present to the group, and it'll be something based on this grid proposal.
Yeah, he told me a little bit about the grid thing. So what's the two minute.
Okay. What it's basically based on, real quickly, up in Wisconsin, 500 miles from the edge of the range, 500 miles west of the range, original range of American chestnut, this old farmer in 1890 planted 9 chestnut trees. We don't even know where they came from. They did very well. And the forest there is a northern oak hickory dominated forest. But since 1890, today probably 50% of the trees grown in that place are American chestnut. And it's spread by this process that I was telling you about. Everything from, we don't know a lot about that, but it's blue jays, squirrels, chipmunks, whatever. So basically what we have seen there in a century or so is that thing's gone about 2 to 3 miles. And not only just survived, but actually got up into the main canopy where it was the dominant species. That tells us more about the ability of this species to repopulate the woods. It's really the same process that occurred 15,000 years ago when the glaciers were setting just north of here and all the hardwood species had retreated down to the Gulf Coast and they came back north. Mm-hmm. And it tells, there certainly weren't any organizations or volunteers out there planting a thing, you know. It made it back over a long period of time. And so that's the basis of this thing. Now, with volunteers, you could accelerate that tremendously. They could not only populate a grid point, but when it got up there, certain size, they could expand that grid point, you know, to another grid point. And but basically, the concept says that let's put the species in a position to succeed. Then we'll let it take care of itself. You know, it's a little more complicated than that.
So what would be the other option, or why it sounds like
the other option, in my mind, would be to line up volunteers, and we go into 100 million acres. We cut little patches of timber out and we plant the trees to try to get it more. Maybe we start on the southern range and we move north. But again, it's such a huge task that there's no way that this country could or would ever devote resources to doing that. It'd be hugely expensive to do that. And to me, that's the only other option. Because for one thing, these trees will need nurturing. You can't just throw the chestnuts out in the woods. Critters eat them. Everything out there, they eat them. In fact, we'll probably have to fence them and take all these precautions to keep them growing. Deer favor this thing. We're covered up with deer right now all over the country. So we have to nurture them and get them up where they can take care of themselves, which is probably 10, 15 years. And it probably begins with a little clear cut, you know, where we give it the best chance of growing rapidly and getting up there where it can take care of itself in the mm-hmm. shortest amount of time. I believe that's the route that we would take. But that's the only other option that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing that will happen, I mentioned earlier, once you get this process started, there's no stopping it. Part of the process will be all my hillbilly cousins who say, damn, I'm going to sneak in there tonight and get me a few of those chestnuts and put them on my place out here. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, in the long range scheme of things, that's probably going to be a huge part of the process. Mm-hmm. Or this guy who owns the land will talk to his cousin or his neighbor and say, yeah, come on up here and we'll get you a few of these. TACF, right now, we tightly control all these chestnuts, you know. They only go to whomever we decide they should go to for testing or whatever. But when you get to that point, we lose control of it. And it's got momentum of its own, and there's no turning back when you do that.
So how
Nor would we want to.
Yeah. How close are you to that point?
I think we're closer than... Now, Hill will tell you this. The fear among these scientists is that somehow... This blight will mutate, and all of a sudden, our trees won't be resistant to it, and that could happen. It could happen. The scientists want to have a long testing period before we actually start activating this grid. 20, 30 years is what our research manager down in Virginia wants. I hope I'm not just letting my enthusiasm for this overrule scientific. I don't think it'll be that long. I think there'd be tremendous pressure, as I've said before, though, to get on with this. And I think the risk is pretty small that we can do a lot of the testing while we're beginning to populate these grids. Mm-hmm. In my view, we could start that process within 5 years. Mm-hmm. And but that's an uphill battle. I don't know if TACF and the scientists whose researchers are generally a pretty conservative group. They won't ever question answered before they, but I think when you look at the world we're dealing with out there, that the risk would be pretty small. That we'll continue the breeding program if we have better sources of resistance that we breed into this tree, and they plan to do that. Hey, when the time comes and we have that, we'll put that out there on the grids and continue the process. But I think it could take place sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. And my view of how we would start the process, we'd start in October, lining up these willing landowners. It is in our interest also to keep as many of the sprouts that are growing out there in the woods as possible. In Kentucky, we lose scads of them every year to strip mining highways. Well, it's true everywhere. So my idea would be to spend the first 5 years salvaging those, pure Americans. Dig them up out of the woods and bring them to these grid points, give our volunteers experience on how to take care of them. And then hopefully 5 years, 7 years, that we would start actively putting this blight-resistant tree out there. Mm-hmm. That's man's plan, and I'm a small cog in that wheel. But mm-hmm. we're
how big are these grids you're talking about?
I think they'd be fairly small. that's another issue we've got to discuss, and we've been calling it a critical mass. This forest I told you about in Minnesota was 9 trees. That was enough to repopulate acres and acres there. We don't really know what it is, but I would view these grid points as being maybe an acre, fairly small. Mm-hmm. They would need to be small if you had to go to the expense of fencing them. Mm-hmm. That's probably going to be solar power electric fencing to keep out deer. So the smaller, generally the better, and probably locate them on a ridgetop where you could, so that you'd have good wind for pollination. And but I think the grid points would be fairly small.
So how many? I know it's like a hard question, but so once the grid plan, say it was initiated and you had them all out there, how long do you think it would take until those trees were repopulated themselves and people could step back?
Well, the other thing that would have to be in place, and this goes to the forestry end of it. If you've got a unbroken canopy out there in the mountains, and you plant a chestnut tree under that, odds are it'll die. That's what happens after 2 or 3 years. It just simply doesn't get enough sunlight. So you got to have disturbance, something that kills or makes an opening in the overstory, so that if you've got a seedling there, a blue jay's planted one or a squirrel, that it has a good chance of competing and getting up there where it can take care of itself. Mm-hmm. It's a very fast-growing tree. I don't think that'll be a problem. In the forests of the east, any private landowner will cut it in every 10, 20 years or so. All these other pests that are coming after us are going to make openings in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that won't be a problem. I think I would guess that once you got a majority, and boy, I'm really getting in over my head here, but I think in a decade or two decades, it would be fairly common to walk through the woods and say, there's a chestnut tree, you know. And the grid point's way over here. But I think you would start to see them show up. It would be greatly accelerated by private individuals, hunters, sportsmen, just people that love the woods and say, I know they don't want any in Mammoth Cave National Park, but I'm going on a hike out there. I want to take me a pocket full of chestnuts and probably plant them. And you'd see that. You know, that would be good or bad. That would be part of it, I think.
So what kind of, say it was successful and chestnuts were assimilated back into the sort of Appalachian region, what kind of role do you think it would have in like the 21st century versus the role it had pre-blight?
I think it would be different. Several things here. One, all through the Appalachians, we're almost at carrying capacity for deer and turkey. We've covered up with them. Too many deer right now. Historically, when you have those conditions, you usually have some sort of catastrophe where you have disease getting the deer herd or massive die-off. We also have all these endangered species, everything from a woods rat that evidence points to it becoming endangered because of the death of the chestnut. So I think the big focus, the big value of this restoration is going to be the wildlife. I really believe that will have much more importance to most people than the timber aspects of it. And I can tell you, timber industry right now are minor supporters of this. They you would think they would be big supporters, but not so. But then having said that, I think a couple things. Everywhere you go now, you see the log cabin. Everybody wants a log home. I think it'd be a huge market. And this is not my idea. This came from the old guy that was the first president of TACF. But I think you would see a great deal of interest in chestnut for that. That was a historic thing. You know, most of the early cabins were built out of chestnut. And I think that would be a huge use of this. The other thing that needs to be looked at, because chestnut outgrows every other hardwood out there, there are real possibilities that you could grow this thing, maybe on strip mines, purely for energy production, where you harvest it every 4 or 5 years, the coppice growth, the sprouts, it's like silage, you whack all of it off, down, chip it up, make ethanol out of it or burn it or whatever, and 5 years later you do it again. I think that would be a real possibility. But the other would be just for things that we use other trees for right now, just regular building. It's a beautiful wood, but it was historically for things like fine furniture, and although I've got all kinds of stuff in this house, that little thing my TV's sitting on is made out of chestnut. That old bench behind you there is part of an old log that came out of a log cabin. But I think those other uses would would be much more critical than building houses or building furniture, I think. But it's the big thing it's got going for it is that mass production and the fact that it grows so fast. It grows like gangbusters.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting through on my questions pretty much. Last is just hopes, concerns, fears, which you've hit on some of those already, but is there any other sort of like take home message or
The longer I work with this, the more I believe, because of the unique nature of this effort, and again, of course, it means more to me as a forester, but this is the first time in the history of mankind that I know of that we've taken something we thought we had lost and restored it. Not just in a small area, but over millions and millions of acres. And when you put that in the context of the danger to these forests out there that exist today, that is huge by any standard right there. When you look at it in that context, and again, it's very significant that this is not a government entity that's done that. This is citizens that wanted to do something. Mm-hmm. Operating on a shoestring, really. But they have been able to pull it off by close adherence to the science, you know. I think it's a great example of what can be done to take care of the things we value out there. And that sounds awful grandiose, but I think that's the nature of the thing. That's the lesson that should come from this. And I even think there is a real danger of waiting too long, you know, to really get this restoration. Even though it's not perfect, we don't have all that questions answered. Mm-hmm. I think we're close enough where we can do more good than harm by getting on with this thing. Mm. I'll probably bore you stiff.
No, it's great. That was really great. I just remembered, will you tell that story about the White House again, just so I have that on audio, because that's kind of a neat little story.
Well, by outliving all my peers, I really had the opportunity to manage, be in charge of some of the worst fires in the history of this country. And as a spinoff of that, in 2002, which wasn't a congressional election year. But this fire in Oregon, the Biscuit Fire, as it came to be called, more money spent on that thing than any other fire in history. Huge amounts of money. Burned about 500,000 acres. So the president came out, and when he came out, there were several Western governors and senators from all over the West, and he had a briefing that I conducted for the president and those folks in Medford, Oregon. And at that time, the president was talking about what needed to be done to stop these fires. It was beginning to be a great concern. So the year following that, which I think would be in the spring of 2003, the Healthy Forest Restoration Act was drafted. And when that was introduced in the Congress, I had the opportunity to go up as the president introduced it. And during that event, I got to go spend a little time with him in the Oval Office, and as we were leaving the Oval Office to go to the area where he was going to hold a press conference, he had a strong interest in trees, and he was showing me, had my Forest Service uniform on, and he was showing me the trees that other presidents had planted. And at that point in time, he had not planted a tree there. So I took the opportunity to bring up the American chestnut and mentioned that that would be a great opportunity to plant a chestnut tree. We were restoring the tree. And he was very enthusiastic about that, even to the point of saying, "Where is it? Get me one, we'll plant it." Chief of the Forest Service was there with a lot of other folks, and after the meeting I let them know this desire of the president's to plant a tree in the White House, a blight resistant chestnut, and several months later that occurred, and in fact after a little bit of misfortune with the first tree, we now have two American chestnut trees growing on White House grounds, and I guess that's this president's presidential tree there. But it was a big deal, and after that, since that time, we've planted trees at George Washington's home place, Thomas Jefferson's home place, Abe Lincoln's home place, just Hippocratic had a little something to do with that one, and but that's gotten to be a big deal. We even planted one at, I'd tell this story real quick. We planted one in Frankfurt at the Capitol building up there. The Secretary of Natural Resources made a little talk, after which we had a tree that we brought from Meadowview, and we were planting that tree. I had my uniform on, and there was about 10 people shoveling dirt into this hole. And I heard a clink, and I'd been having a little trouble with my Forest Service badge. And these are things that are issued to you. They're Forest Service... you have to hang on to those things. Anyhow, and I thought, damn, I lost my badge, and it's in that hole right there. So, and I thought just for a minute, and I said, what the heck? And I just kept throwing dirt. So somewhere around the roots of that chestnut tree that's growing in Frankfurt is a Forest Service badge that somebody will wonder about someday if they dig it up and... but I was able to get another badge, and, but there is one planted along with that tree up there, and I thought that's pretty appropriate, really. That's pretty good. I'll take whatever flack they want to give me on that one.
That's great.
Anyhow, it's still there.
That's a great story. Well, is there anything else you'd think of that would be good to
I'm about talked out, and I know
yeah.
you are. That is
okay.